Well, welcome back to Junior Afternoon. I'm Andy Klein. The Marie Drake Planetarium is one of about 50 stargazing groups across the country that's been named by NASA as an event host for the James Webb Telescope. This designation gives the planetarium access to a steady stream of new images from the telescope. And if you've seen any glimpse of those images, they are absolutely mind-blowing and beautiful. Steve Costas is a board member for the planetarium, and he joins us now to tell us about the presentation tonight on how to interpret those amazing images and some of the science behind the telescope. Steve, thanks so much for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Andy. Do not fear, Steve is here. And that's true. We have two shows tonight at 6 and 7:15 p.m. on the images just released from the James Webb Space Telescope. And I just checked the sign-up, and they're both full. But we do have a wait list, and we do in this show again. There will be images released every week. There's also a public database where the images are available.
Well, tell me a little bit, what is this idea about being an event host? What's that designation, and what does that mean?
Well, the designation is what you just said, that we have access to the images and a large set of databases of videos and text information on the James Webb Space Telescope, and we just applied for it, and we were accepted.
Cool. Well, you know, as an enthusiast in this area, just tell me a little bit about your reaction to these images as you saw them. It was almost emotional how amazing and beautiful they were. What was your reaction when you saw them?
Oh yeah, the same way. You know, they're very well presented. And what was interesting to me is the Hubble images are done in visible light. So the colors that we see from the Hubble are what we would see with our eye. But the Webb telescope uses a set of the spectrum in the infrared, the near and mid-infrared, that is not visible to our eyes. And so the colors that we see in the Webb images have to be selected not only for their scientific content, but for the artistic aesthetic aspect of it. So there are image processors who not only look at the science for the images, but look at how they're actually false colors, how they'll appear in the images. So it's a kind of a fusion of art and science for these Webb images, and that's what kind of impressed me.
That's interesting. So is there any sort of... is there any sort of rule book around, like, oh, if it's showing blue, that means nitrogen, or if it's showing red, that means heat, or is there anything like that, or is it just purely up to artistic interpretation?
Well, it's both. You know, as they say, it's a right brain, left brain kind of fusion where the left brain is logic and the right brain is art. So, yeah, it's both. The main interest, though, in bringing out the images from the Webb is the structure that's shown. So, There is a waiting on selecting the color tables, and it's false color tables to bring out structure in the images. For example, the Southern Ring Planetary Nebula, they picked the color tables to bring out the structure in the expanding shells of the dying star at the center of the Southern Ring Planetary Nebula.
Tell me a little bit about, if you could sort of coach people when they're looking at these new images about what to keep in mind when they're looking at it. What are some of the key things that you think people should keep in their mind and think about as they're looking at these images beyond just the beauty of what they see?
Oh, well, what's quite interesting is that the sensitivity of this telescope is such that some of the fainter objects that are seen in all the images, even when we're taking images in the galaxy, the fainter points of light are distant galaxies that just showed up in the field of view of the image. So you're actually seeing kind of ancillary images that weren't the original intention of the scientists, but show up anyway and can open up additional paths of research. And that's one of the beauties of science. Is a lot of times when we collect data, we end up with new information and new questions and in a mind-expanding sense.
Yeah, you know, I was watching some of the live reveal that the NASA conducted, and I remember one of the scientists there who was describing what they had found and what they were seeing said, you know, we can't point to an empty spot in space anymore. It's not, you know, we see something every place we point this telescope. We got a little bit of a feel for that with Hubble when they did that pointing into a very dark, what they thought was a very dark spot in the star field, and, you know, discovered this field of galaxies. But it seems like this is even more so, and it's interesting because on the one hand we think of space as so vast and empty, and on the other hand here it is just absolutely chock full of objects, massive objects.
Well, the imagery there is, you know, you're talking about the Hubble Ultra Deep Field image, right, which was a 12-day time exposure. Well, the image released on July 11th with the president officiating, now called the Webb Ultra Deep Field image, was a 12-hour exposure. And it shows, and also the field of view of that, it's a grain of sand held at arm's length. That's the actual field of view. That's the extent of that field. So it's just a grain of sand in the sky. And there's literally thousands of galaxies in that one image. That's just a very, 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 very small subset of our universe.
And it shows how very, very small we are, doesn't it? I mean, it is amazing. Gives you such perspective, really. It's incredible. I think it's also fascinating to me, and it's just something, of course, that's known and that I knew before, but I just got another appreciation for of how much you're looking through time when you see these images.
Oh, yes, that ultra deep image from the Webb, the foreground cluster of galaxies that are globular galaxies, that's 4.7 billion light years away. So that's how distant we're looking into the past, because telescopes are basically time machines looking in the past. But what's fascinating about that image is there are these circular halos of these distorted wisps. And it's a fortuitous instance that there's a cluster of galaxies behind that foreground cluster of galaxies that are then gravitationally lensed. It was predicted by Einstein's general theory that were actually magnifying and also showing much brighter than they would be initially. So we have this 4.7 billion light year long telescope, basically, that we're using for the gravitational lensing in that image. And it was fortuitous. Just happened that those foreground galaxies had much further galaxies behind them. The foreground galaxies were about 4.7 billion light years away. The ones, the distorted ones, I don't have the image to show right now, are up to 13 billion light years away in the past.
And those were ones, as I remember, they're sort of shown, they're a little bit redder or more orange, and they look like if you were to take a galaxy and kind of stretch it out and bend it a little bit, that's kind of how they look. And it's because, as you're saying, that's not how they actually look. That is just because we're looking through a gravitational field that's warping our view of them. Do I have that correct?
Yeah, it's a perfect example of space-time curvature. The mass of the foreground cluster of galaxies is warping space in such a way that it acts as a lens. So we have this incredible telescope that's formed from space itself, space-time curvature, that we're seeing. And there's other instances of that. But this was fortuitous, that this background cluster was right behind the foreground cluster.
Are there other things? Are there certain, are you aware of certain either questions or experiments or that kind of thing that are specific to what scientists want to see out of the James Webb telescope?
Well, that's just very interesting. The images that we see are not the primary science of the James Webb telescope. What the primary science is the spectroscopy that is done with the James Webb. So all those galaxies, the foreground galaxies and the distant background galaxies, there's a slitless spectrograph that analyzes the light, and it can show us the frequency and amplitude of the wavelengths. It also shows us the distance to those galaxies. And in fact, those distorted ones, the reason they're red and orange is because they're at such a distance that the light that is reaching us from them has been redshifted. The light has been stretched out, so it's shifted towards the red, and that shows up in the spectrum. So from the spectrum, we can see the elements that are present. We can also see how far away these galaxies are. If the galaxy is moving away from us, it's redshifted. If it's coming towards us, it's blue shifted. It's Doppler shift for light. There's also Doppler shift for sound,
which is,
as we know, in a siren.
Like a train going by, the Doppler shift.
Yeah, exactly, right. Exactly. But right. It happens with light also.
That's fascinating, and yeah, that's really interesting and fascinating. Is there Is there some specific finding or some specific area of what has been laid out that is being worked on by James Webb that you're particularly excited about or interested in?
Well, I'm kind of interested in the early universe. The Big Bang was now dated pretty definitively at 13.8 billion light years ago. And it looks like the James Webb will be able to look at objects that were created about 200 million years after the Big Bang. So this would be the early evolution of galaxies. Initially, they look like they were quite irregular. And also, there's very interest in how supermassive black holes are formed. It seems like every galaxy has a supermassive black hole at the center. And why is that? And why does it get so big? Because there doesn't seem to be, there's small black holes that form from where a single star collapses. And then there's these supermassive black holes. So the question is, how do these supermassive ones form? Do they just collect stars? Stars get drawn in, or is it some other mechanism? So that's my interest, is it would be called early cosmology, the evolution of the universe from the Big Bang.
And is there evidence of that early Big Bang even in our galaxy? Or are we considered a newer galaxy, or is it known? Or
we're not a first generation galaxy. We're a multi-generation galaxy. So our galaxy was formed from the debris of previous galaxies that had collided with one another. And when two galaxies collide or interpenetrate, the stars don't intersect. It's the gas in the galaxies intersects. Galaxies are so huge that even if they have trillions of stars, when they interpenetrate each other, the stars really don't collide. It's the gas that collides and causes high energy systems that could possibly be the formation of these supermassive black holes.
Wow. That's so fascinating. Well, Steve, it's so interesting to talk to you about this. And it was, I think that the pictures that were seen from the James Webb Telescope just really bring you back to the value of an institution like the one that you're so involved in, the planetarium. Do you think that these pictures that are coming out and the popular interest in it is something that's a boon for the planetarium?
Oh, certainly. Through the contribution of local donors here in Alaska, we have a brand new digital system. I was just recently in Anchorage, and our system is the equivalent of the Rasmussen planetarium system. And we have a full dome projector. It uses a fisheye lens, so we'll be able to immerse ourselves in the imagery, and we can zoom in and out with the system we have right now. And I think our audience will be quite changed by seeing the images on the 30-foot dome in our planetarium, which was built in 1967.
Wow.
It's been around 50-plus years.
That's amazing. Wow, almost as long as I have, yeah. Well, you mentioned that the two presentations tonight are filled and that there is a waiting list, but do you have to plan to have more of these in the future soon, or you got anything on the books yet, or what's your ideas there? Sounds like there's definitely
demand. We've been doing, we've been doing public shows for a year now. So yeah, we certainly do more shows on the James Webb. And like I said, there's a public database. You can actually go in yourself and get these images. And if you have access to image processing software, you can do your own image process. So there is an avenue for the amateur scientist to get some of these images and see things and publish on it possibly. I mean, usually publications now have hundreds of authors, but there is some pathway for maybe an individual author to look at some of these images and come up with a new idea that they can publish.
Right.
So, well, it's just for amateur science.
Yeah. Well, great to talk to you, Steve. Thanks so much for taking the time and telling us about this, the James Webb Telescope, and how it seems like it's really a game changer, obviously, for space exploration and for understanding the origins of our universe.
Yeah, and it's quite interesting. It's parked at the Lagrange point, L2, which is one of these parking spots that gravitationally balanced between the Earth and the Sun. There's five of them. And the James Webb is not the only sensor there. The Solar Observatory SOHO is there. The WMAP microwave cosmic background is there. The Gaia that's mapping stars in our galaxy is there. And the Planck microwave cosmic background satellite. So the parking spot's getting full with all these different sensors. It's an ideal place to park.
About how far up is that? Or about how far away is that?
It's a million miles from the Earth away from the Sun. And these five points, they're called the Lagrange points, move in lockstep with the Earth. As the Earth revolves around the Sun, all these points move with the Earth, relative to the Earth. In fact, there's speculations that what are called the L4 and L5 points would be places to put space colonies. Gerard O'Neill, astronomer in the 60s, made this conjecture. So, and also there's an L1 point that's totally, it's on the opposite side of the sun. And there's a lot of science fiction stories about there's a parallel Earth opposite from the sun that moving, is blocked by the sun.
Yes.
But we have sent sensors there and there is no.
There's no, it's Earth. That's all.
It was sci-fi.
It's fiction.
It was interesting.
It's the fiction part of science fiction.
Yeah, there you go.
Well, Steve, thanks so much. Steve's a volunteer and the board member on the Marie Drake Planetarium, Steve Kosas. Steve, thanks so much for taking time to talk to us about this. It's exciting stuff. I could talk about it for hours, but we have to keep moving on here. But thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Namaste, Andy.
Thank you.